to come, but while it does come, Kathy Kelly, who many of you know and are related to, has agreed to come out and speak with us about state of affairs in Afghanistan and Iraq. And she's been to Pakistan and lived with the people and, you know, really has the feel for that part of the world. And we're so glad to have her here. She is very motivational, voices for creative nonviolence, speaks about drones, just a whole bunch of things, and we're so glad to have her here. And as I said, we're waiting for a computer, and then she'll have other things to project on the screen. But until it gets here, here she is.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon. I'm very happy to be here and happy to be here with members of my family and also people who taught me in high school. We used to call our school the school with the family spirit, so it does feel familial being with so many good familiar faces. Thank you. And thank you for thinking about something that's so hard to reckon with. You know, I guess the most important ethical question we all face is how can we learn to live together without killing one another? And our track record of wars is certainly one that makes that question all the more gripping for us. I would like to start with something very familial. My sister Pat fielded a lot of phone calls from me. Pat's a nurse, and we all call her when we get sick. I don't have health insurance, so I call her more than the others. But she's a good replacement. Anyway, we were taking care of our dad over a period of, I think, about 8 years. And as happens if you're a caregiver for an elderly person, if the person wakes up in the middle of the night, you go running. Our dad happened to have an internal catheter, so it was a good idea to run a little faster. And there were several times toward the end of Dad's life when he woke up and he'd say, "Kath, Kath, yeah, Dad, what's wrong? It's not right." And I'd be thinking, "Oh, well, what happened the day before? What happened today? What's the matter, Dad? Those kids over there in Haiti, they shouldn't go to bed hungry at night." And another time, "Kath, Kath, what's the matter, Dad? Those kids you told me about in Iraq, they shouldn't have to die from hunger." And then toward the very end of his life, this World War II veteran called for me, and I sat next to him. "What's the matter, Dad? We shouldn't have dropped that bomb on Hiroshima. We shouldn't have bombed Nagasaki." And there we were, you know, two frail people sitting at the edge of a bedside with many more questions than answers. But I knew that my dad would understand. And the deep heart score, as Yeats would say. The women that I've met recently in Afghanistan, much younger, they, like he, him, want to be breadwinners, want to make sure that the family is provided for. And in succession, a few seasons ago, I was in Kabul in Afghanistan living in a home that we rent and we make it available for the Afghan peace volunteers. And these were neighborhood women. I mean, maybe they thought, well, there's a Westerner there, maybe she can help us. So they came over and there were greetings and some getting to know one another. But before the conversation ended, each one had said some version of, "I think I'm losing my mind. What's the matter, Nakbat? I think I'm becoming mentally unstable. What's wrong, Sakina? Sometimes I feel that I am going mad. What's the matter, Nori?" And in each case, it was the same thing. "I cannot feed my children." And so through our dear good friend Hakim, who's a medical doctor and a wonderful translator, I learned that in each case, what they were, I said, "Well, ask what they're eating each day. What are they having for meals?" And with a sense of shame and looking down, stale bread and tea without sugar. And you see, with the economic sanctions against Iran, that's actually had a spillover effect on Afghanistan because the price of oil goes up and Afghanistan imports much of its wheat from Iran. And even just a little rise in price made a huge difference, a cataclysmic difference for these women, because they don't have any buffer zone, they don't have any savings, and so they're not able to feed their children. And in a way, they're so much better off than many, many others in Kabul and in Afghanistan. A statistic, I look at it and I think, no, somebody made a mistake, but I've doubled and triple checked it. It comes from Amnesty International. Warfare in Afghanistan drives 400 people every day into the cities. And there's no place for them to go. Kabul was built for 5 million people. It's got 15 million people there now. And so in the cold winters, in this winter, in the past previous winter, oh my word, it's so cold over there. The pipes freeze and there's no water if the pipes are frozen, and if you're dependent on your well for water and the well is dependent on electricity and then the electricity goes out, you don't have any water. Well, that's when you're lucky enough to have a roof over your head. But with 400 new people every day coming into the cities, they go into these squalid, horrible refugee camps. And when the rains come, they're just living in the midst of mud and slime. And when the snow comes, well, 28 children froze to death in Kabul in January of 2012. And so I live with these youngsters who have themselves been no strangers to war and displacement. Abdullahi, when he was just a little toddler, the grandmother remembers having had to put him in a hammock over an open flame to thaw out his body when he lived in a refugee camp. These kids have been displaced. Faiz's brother was killed right before his eyes. When Abdullahi did reunite with the family, he and his brothers learned that their father had been killed. They've undergone a great deal of loss and bereavement and displacement. But they have big hearts, and they're like teenagers everywhere, but figure out, well, what can we do? Some problem solving. And so they decided that they would invite the women to come into their home and form a sewing co-op. Somebody, Fahima Vorgets, a lovely woman, an Afghan-American woman, had offered them sewing machines. And so they said, yes, 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 we'll take the sewing machines. And there were these antiquated old sewing machines that broke more often than they functioned. But they started a sewing co-op. And so I'm really touched by this. The kids roll up their own bedding in the morning and they hang a big curtain so that the women who are particularly conservative won't feel anxious that they'll be seen. And the sewing machines start whirring. And over the course of this past winter, the women made 2,000 heavy blankets for distribution free of charge to the people less fortunate than them. And they were paid a small amount of money. They called it the Dubai Project. And it just gave us a lot of hope. It gave people something to come together on. And it gave people from the United States a chance to be very, very generous. So that was a good thing. But it also gave me a whole new insight into what's been happening in Afghanistan. Because the young people, two young women and two young men, and that was kind of good that, young women and young men were doing something together and they didn't get killed for it, but they would go up the mountaintop and take me with them to find out who is most in need of the heavy blankets that aren't living in refugee camps. Well, my heart was thudding, going up the mountaintop. I'm not all that limber. I think in high school I was so glad that at St. Paul's we didn't have gym class. I loved all of you for many reasons, but we also didn't have gym class. So my heart was thudding, and I thought, I'm going to pass out. And so we stopped and paused, and I looked up higher, and there were women dressed in really kind of flimsy clothing compared to the cold weather, and they had on their heads or strapped to their shoulders big, huge containers. They had to walk 25 minutes downhill to get water, and they do it every morning, and then strap that on their bodies and go up the mountainside. And it's treacherous. I mean, there is no road as you get up higher, and it's icy and rutted and very narrow. And of course, they do this every morning with the heavy containers of water. And you see what happens is that if water is piped into a one-room home, the landlord will boost up the rent. So the widows who have no income, who have no support, have to move up higher and higher, and that means they have to go further and further to get the water every day. So we went into Khareb's home, and she had they called a bukhari, a small stove, and she constantly shelled almonds. She and her daughter, the whole time we were there, listening to her story. And she used the shells with a small shovel for fuel. Shoveled the almond shells, and that gave a bit of heat. And there was no latrine inside her home. That had to be an outdoor latrine. Next door to her, oh, by the way, they sell the almonds, so that gave them a little bit of income. But next door to her, there were 8 people living in one room. And they had the misfortune of very severe damage because the snow comes in. You know, the rooms aren't constructed all that well. And their room was so damaged, they all moved in with Horeb. No. It's just so typical. Well, widows and orphans are pushed up. It troubles me deeply that many people across the United States who have good hearts will say, well, we don't want the U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan because what would the women and children do? They'll be left defenseless. And I think, oh, we have to stop and look at the statistics. 1 out of every 11 women in Afghanistan dies in childbirth, a tortuous way to die. 1 out of every 4 children, some say 5, some say 4, doesn't make it beyond the age of 5. So imagine the women that we think our military is protecting, 1 out of every 4 going to the cemetery with the bundle of their child, a corpse. 1 million children are suffering acute malnourishment. And if you have acute malnourishment and then you get a respiratory disease, and I swear half the country in the wintertime comes down with severe respiratory diseases, it's not survivable. And so there is, meanwhile, for instance, right across the road from the largest and most squalid refugee camp I've ever seen, right across the road is a huge U.S. military base. It costs $2 billion per week, $2 billion per week, to keep the United States military in Afghanistan at the extent that it has been since the surge. $2 billion for 1 week. And right across the road, while the trucks are going into the U.S. military base with food and water and fuel, right across the road, children are freezing to death. So, I have a very good friend named Felipe. He's a nurse, and he's at the emergency hospital. The Italians run these extraordinary hospitals in a kind of a network, and there are 3 of them in Afghanistan. And they'll stitch up anybody. They don't ask any questions. I found that I was the only one asking lots of questions. They just go right to work. And Felipe knew that it costs $1 million to keep one soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year. And one day he said to me, kind of impishly almost, "Allora, Kathy, just you let the 6 go home and you give me that money, what I do?" Well, that would be $6 million. He could fund all 3 hospitals. And he said, "You send 60 home. Wow, we build 33 new clinics." And it's a reasonable way to think. You know, I think regarding the issue of madness, you know, the women felt that they were going mad. But I think the most obvious and glaring madness is in the ongoing warfare. Even just on a logistical level, this might sound unbelievable, but it can cost from $400 to $800 to fill 1 tank of an airborne or a landborne vehicle in Afghanistan. Now, you know, my sister's never taught me how to drive. I don't know why, but they can tell you. So I don't even know how to drive. I'm good on that bicycle. But I'm sure $400 sounds absolutely extraordinary, huh? Why would it cost so much? Well, so one experience that I did have with drug trade was teaching on the second floor of a building in the uptown area. And my students were members of the Harrison Gents and the Latin Kings, and on their lunch hour, they all went out to work selling drugs. And I would look out the window, and I could start to see that, you know, one has one corner in one gang, and one has another corner in the other gang, and you do not occupy the other person's corner. And in fact, the stakes got so serious sometimes that some of our students were killed. Well, Hello, thank you for coming. Oh, that's Jim Bernierski. Wow, hey.
Chicago Dog Society to the rescue.
Get the sun film. You are a hero. Thank you so much. Well, that was
all right. Thanks, Jim.
Wow, hey. How do you work it? We'll come back. We'll catch up with it. We'll use it. I promise. We better use our computer.
I don't know.
Anyway, what I want to get at is that 90% of 92% of the world's opium comes from Afghanistan, and it's the largest exporter. The country is the largest exporter of marijuana in the world. Now, it's curious to me that with all the drone surveillance that goes on, these people operating the drones don't happen to notice that there's quite a heavy drug trade going up and down the roadways. But warlords and drug lords would never say to people who want to use the roadways, oh, sure, welcome aboard, it's free of charge. They're going to boost the price up as high as they possibly can. Now, the only way that the supplies for all those military bases, we have three main military bases, and it's hard to find out exactly how many, but one supposition is 450 forward operating bases in Afghanistan. You can't fly the food and the fuel and the water in. It just isn't going to work. The planes would be too heavy. They'd crash. It's all done by truck. So the trucking industry to deliver supplies to the U.S. troops is dependent on the people who more or less own the roadways, who are the warlords and the drug lords. So the reason it can cost $400 to $800 to fill 1 gallon of gasoline in an airborne or landborne U.S. military vehicle is because the drug lords and the warlords bilk them for every cent they can get, and that's why the price goes so, so high. So U.S. taxpayer money is being given to the very people we're supposedly fighting against in order to do the deliveries of supplies to the U.S. troops. It's a bit of a madness, isn't it?
Thumb drive.
I had it in my hand, she said. Oh, Dale will look for it. Thank you. Some things never change. Remember the time I lost my shoe on State Street and got it back? Now, another instance of what I would... Oh, I know what to do now.
There.
Okay. What I would consider... madness, but I want to preface this with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's words. He said, have tough minds, tender hearts. So let us not lose that tender heart side. But there's a man named Neil Shea who embedded himself with U.S. military in Afghanistan several times. And he began to grow initially close to the people he was embedded with as soldiers because he felt, you know, they're saving my life, you know, this is a very dangerous place where we are. But in his last article in the spring 2012 issue of the American Scholar, he said that he had begun to fear the soldiers that he was with. And he described in particular the night raids. And the night raids are conducted by soldiers who are on orders to just unexpectedly burst into a home, tear the place apart, and try to see if there might be weapons or there might be cell phones they want to confiscate, or maybe there's a HVT, high-value target that they want to grab. Maybe they want to take someone for interrogation. So the name of the game is to go in like gangbusters. Well, he said that they would tornado through houses. They would sometimes burn a house down, immediately hogtie the householder and the other men in the house and put them in the back of a pickup truck. But sometimes, you know, they would just leave them there for hours and hours and hours, hogtied, and then they put a meal in front of them. It's not a war crime, but, you know, when somebody's hogtied and hungry and thirsty, and then they put the meal in front of them that they can't eat. They would deliberately, rip apart all of the mattresses and empty out the cupboards and cabinets, and, you know, they have to look to make sure a place isn't booby-trapped. But meanwhile, even the Afghan National Army people, whom they were training to do this themselves, were saying, Mister, please, and trying to stop them because it was just going too far. And at the end of it all, thank you so much, Laurel, at the end of it all, the staff sergeant, Neil Shea gives a fictitious name to the unit. He calls them the Destroyers, and he calls the staff sergeant, Sergeant Givens. At the end of it, Sergeant Givens said, you know, you could say we just did a week-long recruitment drive for the Taliban. Do you see what he's saying? That this would cause people to be so angry, they'd go and join the people that are fighting. And then he said, and you know what? We had fun doing it. I like recruiting for the Taliban. It's job security. Job security. And so the reason I want to remind myself and all of us about tender hearts is that we must have tender hearts, particularly for Sergeant Givens when he comes home. Do you know the greatest cause of harm to the United States veterans now is self-inflicted harm? 22 committing suicide per day? Sure, there's talk of bravado. But then when you have memories and you come back and try to adjust, and the adjustment isn't going so easily, it's a very, very, very difficult reality. And now these Afghan peace volunteers whom I've been talking about have in their group an Afghan National Army person who decided to leave the army. And he also had tried to kill himself. And it's very, very important for us to listen to all the sides that are bearing the brunt of the warfare. And part of the problem, of course, is that by and large across the United States after this 10-year mark, people have kind of forgotten that the war is even going on. And so before turning to a few videos, I'd like to say that in Iraq, when I was starting to eye my passport and thinking, well, I've been here 6 months and the war, the bombing has ended and the occupation has begun, I wanted to go home. And I walked up to my friend, Umilada. She'd become my very good friend. You know, I'd hold her kids while the bombing was going on, and sometimes she was shaking so hard, you know, I didn't want her to hold them because she'd frighten the children. And so we were really close. And I wanted to take the girls outside, you know. It was finally, there weren't explosions. And so I first went over to check with her. She was staring out the window. And I realized tears were rolling down her face. And then I looked, and I'd started to just take it for granted. But soldiers, U.S. Marines, were uncurling barbed wire. And they were setting up a checkpoint in their military vehicles, these big, huge armored personnel carriers and Humvees and bulldozers were parked outside the hotel where we stayed in, but now they're setting up the barbed wire for a checkpoint. And you could tell she had a lump in her throat, and she looked up at me and she said, Kathy, never before did I think that this would happen to my country. And I feel very sad, she said. And I think that this sadness, it will never go away. And all of a sudden, I realized, I'm in the airport, you know, in Jordan, thinking I'm going to go home. And she's home. Mm-hmm. And this sadness, it will never go away. So the war doesn't end. Ann Jones wrote a brilliant book, War Isn't Over When It's Over. It doesn't end except for those who lose their lives. The war goes on and mercilessly on in people's memories and the ways that they're afflicted, and actually, quite honestly, in Iraq, there's likely a new civil war breaking out. And in Afghanistan, outside of Kabul, you could say there's a civil war. And meanwhile, you know, we have something akin to a war against the poor in our own country. You know, we've not only got the military-industrial complex, now we've got the security-industrial complex, too, with so many jobs dependent on... Hello, Siobhan, hi. Their seats right up here, right smack in front. with such a rise in our own imprisonment of people, that jobs are located either with the military or with the prison industry. And, you know, it's difficult. People are afraid to lose their jobs. They want to take care of their children. And yet, collectively, and in the long run, I think we all know that the greatest fear we all face is the fear of what we're doing to our own environment. So on that note, I would like to just offer you three kind of contrasts between my experiences as a city person and what I've started to learn from people who live in a very, very, very different experience in Afghanistan and in many parts of Iraq as well. And the first has to do with fuel. You know, I often say, how long does it take me to adjust to being back in the United States after I've been away for a while? About 8 seconds. Lights on, forget to turn them off. Hot water, of course, why not? I just consume. I'm like, and so it's very challenging to me to be with my friends Gulamai and Ali, who, when they're with their family in the central northern highlands of Afghanistan, in a province called Bamyan, get up typically at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they ride on their donkeys for 6 hours. And then when they get to a spot on the mountainside where they can start to collect just scrub brush, it looks like tumbleweed almost, they collect it, they shove it into their burlap sacks on either side of the donkey, and then ride 6 hours back, you know, and sometimes this is on icy roads. And can you imagine how fast what they've collected burns? And that's their fuel. They don't have electricity. Sometimes they will between 1 and 3 in the morning. So, so when I show this video to young university students, they'll often say, you know, we could help you. Because the videos are so amateur. I didn't make them, our friend Hakim, but I kind of like to use these because they're made in a context where electricity and internet and, you know, the whistles and bells are not so available. But this...
Oh, this is not a video.
Yeah. So let me just see if I can't pull this up quickly.
Use the mouse if you like.
The mouse.
Yes.
Thank you.
Let me see. Yeah. Go there and
go to computer.
Under computer to the right. Computer.
I'm trainable. We think. I'm not sure.
Right there.
Okay. So this is called Children, Fuel, and Fire.
Okay.
Are there speakers on this, do you think? Oh, maybe it doesn't work. Oh, thank you for your patience. I think maybe this doesn't quite work, huh? Well, you can go.
Is it on YouTube?
Yeah, but those are jumpy usually. Anyway, I did want to encourage everybody that there's a website called Global Days of Listening. And if you're ever in a down mood, there are 120 of these little short 3-minute videos. And they'll pick you up. They're very heartening, and this one would have shown Ali and Gulamai riding out to collect their fuel. But at the end, there's one subtitle that says, in the mountains there is life in the early morning. You know, I mean, this is after you've seen these kids with a pickaxe wrestling the fuel, these scrub brush, out of the mountainside. And it's really hard work, and you just see what hardworking, attractive kids they are. But the subtitle says, but if U.S. helicopters fly overhead, morning becomes night. And you see, this has happened repeatedly. Combat Brigade Unit helicopters, the largest vehicle in the U.S. airborne arsenal. These things must be absolutely menacing when they fly overhead. They have the same engine that you'd find in an Abrams tank. These combat brigade unit helicopters fly over the mountainside, and they're on orders. Now, maybe their orders came after somebody had been watching the mountainside with, in Afghanistan they call them tayara bedun pilot, airplane without pilot, a drone. So if you could just imagine that Laurel and I are high-fiving each other because we've graduated from the United States Air Force Academy, stranger things could happen. And we're pilots, right? But we never get in a plane, huh? We get inside a dimly lit trailer, and Laurel watches the screen, and I listen for the directions, and Laurel's eyesight is as sharp as can be. And she's very, very good at being able to identify moving figures, and there's a high-value target we're supposed to try and identify on a mountainside. And there are these figures moving around at, you know, twilight. It's not, the sun hasn't even gone up yet. And plausibly, these could be Taliban fighters. It has happened again and again that children have been mowed down in cold blood by combat brigade unit helicopters. In one instance, one little boy, Wahidullah, was immediately covered by the branches of a tree. When the firing started, the tree cracked in half, and the branches covered this little 13-year-old. So he watched, and what he described was that the two helicopters had gone up the side of the mountain in the air, and then there was a bright green flash, and then one came down lower, and then a gun came out, and nine children were killed. And can you imagine the parents? You know, they hear the explosions in the mountainside, and they come running, no doubt hoping that it's not what they think it is, and then they find the dismembered and bloodied bodies of their children. Well, Wahidullah told his story, and the U.S. apologized the next day. General Petraeus was in charge at the time, and he said, this tragic event should never have happened. And of course, that was true. But his replacement, now General John Allen, has apologized repeatedly. We keep on our website, vcnv.org, a kind of a macabre update, and we update every time that there's been a United States or NATO or ISAF military attack against civilians. And the Taliban have killed more people. There is no doubt there. But we can't be responsible for the payment, the funding, the organizing of the Taliban. We do bear responsibility for the U.S. military. And, of course, you know, across Afghanistan, people are enraged. And President Hamid Karzai keeps asking, why are you killing children? And mothers who are out collecting fuel. I want to go back to Southwest Side for many of us who grew up on the Southwest Side or taught many of us. And, you know, after you went to high school, you went to college. We just didn't even think too much about it. Well, in Afghanistan, for somebody in an ordinary neighborhood, and an ordinary neighborhood is a poor neighborhood because, you know, the majority of the people are, well, 36% are beneath the poverty line, but there's a great deal of impoverishment. To go to university is like almost unheard of if you don't have connections. I mean, the seats at the university are basically sold before anybody even takes an entrance test. So in the village in Maidan Vardak, where two boys in one family, the Nemati family, had managed to make it into university, this was like, you know, a huge status symbol. And the village was enormously proud of Ismail Nemati at the Kabul University and Burnula Nemati studying at the Kabul Polytechnic. And it's the first night of Ramadan, and no matter where you are, you try to be with your family. This is the first night of a month of fasting. And so the two boys had managed to make it back to their village to be with their family. Hooray. And what they couldn't know is that the night before, there had been a knock on the door of what they call the family compound. And two, presumably Taliban fighters, had come to that compound to ask for food. You can't say, well, 7-Eleven is over there and Motel 6 is that way. There's just not, there's hardly even a road leading up to some of these more remote areas. And so it's the custom. If people ask you for food, you give it to them. But by the time they get to a next spot where they can ask, they could, you know, be dehydrated or die on the road. So, or, and also if they have guns, you might think, well, maybe we'll give it to them because they might, anyway. They came in, they went out, they were long gone. Now, if Laurel and I are at work and we're asked to identify high-value targets, and one of them is one of these guys, and then we see the next night two more come, how are we to know it's the first night of Ramadan and these might be the two sons coming home? So this is the kind of thing that, now in this instance, what was ordered was a night raid. Hellfire missiles weren't shot into the home, there was a night raid. Again, we're relying on the testimony of a young teen who said he went in to be with his brothers. They fell asleep studying over their books after the big family meal. And then all of a sudden, he thought the soldiers had raced in to wake his brothers up. But there must have been some sense of altercation, and the military have orders. If there's any resistance, you can shoot to kill. And there were three pools of blood. Ismail tried to speak in English, saying, we are students, we are not fighters. He was pulled out. There was another shot. he was killed, and the two brothers with him studying were killed. And on the other end of the compound, there was another older brother, and an Afghan National Army translator had put a bag over, a sack over his head, and was walloping him repeatedly on one side of the head and then on the other, saying, "Tell us where the guns are, tell us where the guns are." And that young man, Faribullah, said, "Believe me, if you find any guns, bring them here and shoot me with them. There are no guns in this house." And then the next day, the U.S. military apologized. Wrong house. So the night raids, the aerial bombardments, the drone attacks, and these drone attacks have happened so repeatedly, and again, tough minds but tender hearts. Because, you know, if two people are working in a dimly lit trailer, don't think the adrenaline doesn't start to charge. Sometimes, you know, Laurel, if she was in this job, might have been following this guy for a week, you know, and she knows where the high-value target stops to pray, knows where the high-value target goes to market, knows the high-value, and then all of a sudden the order comes, impact, and hey, you know, now we really have to zero in. This is it. We're supposed to get this guy today. And, you know, you have the crosshairs focused, and then all of a sudden that's it. Impact, and you see the body parts flying and clumps of mud, and then catch the, hey, aren't you supposed to pick your kid up at the soccer field? Some of the soldiers and pilots have said, we're 18 inches away from the war, and we're 8,000 miles away from the war. And actually, cases of post-traumatic stress are coming up amongst the Air Force personnel who operate the drones. So the drone proliferation is becoming rapidly a big part of our world. I mean, my goodness, now Israel is manufacturing drones and selling them to China, and China's selling them to Pakistan, and where does it end? So we have so much that we need to think about together with regard to this question of how can we learn to live together without killing one another. I'm by no means hopeless. I see these youngsters in Afghanistan, and you know, they've sustained plenty, and they're very, very keen on saying, we want to live without wars. That's the number one. And they've made an impact. They've had a very extensive influence through their Skype phone calls once a month on the 21st of every month. They have a Skype phone call. The preparation call was just happening this morning. And they talk with people in war zones all around the world, people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, people who have fled wars in Gaza and haven't been able to go very far. They've really been, with open hearts and open minds, making connections, actually worldwide. And then many people have gone over to visit them now, and they'll start up this duvet project again. So I can't help but feel heartened and hopeful just in that one-to-one kind of connection. But I also think that what we have as we try to envision a better world is the power of persuasion. And I think it's important to be with the grassroots. You know, people say, well, aren't you preaching to the choir? And I think, yeah, that's okay. You know, the choir needs a tune-up sometimes, and so do I. But I think sometimes it's maybe necessary to widen out our sense of the grassroots, because it could be that even within corporate America, even within very elite groups who have their hands on leverage that we almost can't imagine, there's love for the grandchildren. There's a desire to see this beautiful planet survive. And there's conscience. You know, after World War I, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was signed and it outlawed war. That's not so long ago, and they changed their mind pretty darn quick. But we also had, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, 3 days before he left office, said, after he'd presided over the greatest buildup of arsenals, weapons anywhere in the world, he said he gave us the whole concept of military-industrial complex. He said, beware the unwarranted influence of an undue buildup of the military-industrial complex. In fact, he had said military-industrial-congressional complex. And Scoop Jackson said, oh, Mr. President, we have to work with that Congress, so how about you leave them out? But that is part of the problem, you know, that we have such a huge influence of the lobbies, those that lobby for weapons and those that lobby for war, the war profiteers, because they're able to almost own the Congress people. So I'm not saying it's easy, but I do think it's plausible that we, we're 6% of the world's population, and the remaining 94% of the world's population, it's not hard to believe that there are many, many, many communities like yourselves who are trying to figure out what's going on with these wars. You know, why does it seem like there's almost an addiction to warfare, and how could we bring it, our societies, into a new way of being, a new way of living together? When I was in high school, there was this place called St. Benet's Bookstore. Remember that, Leona? Mm-hmm. I used to go in there and read the greeting cards and these banners, and I'd be cutting out felt and making these kind of tacky-looking banners and giving them to people for Christmas presents. But Daniel Berrigan was a beloved poet, and his lines were always coming out on the cards and on the banners. He's 93 years old now. He's so frail and dear, and if you're good your whole life long, you get to be Daniel Berrigan when you're older. And he wrote a poem called Some, and he kind of puts out the idea, well, you know, some people walked and a few miles and then stopped, and some people sat in and then they stood up and walked. And so people ask the ones who, you know, are still trying to figure it out, well, why do you keep going? And the answer is so simple. Because of the bread, and because of the children, and because of the heart's beat. The heart's beat, the bread risen, and the children. And so for the sake of children worldwide, I'm very, very glad that your good hearts and minds have come together today. I'm sorry not to have some visuals, but I can rig up some photos that are on a PowerPoint before we leave. But let's stop me talking on without an off switch and hear from you. Your thoughts, ideas, questions, comments. We have some great minds in this room. Yes, thank you. Could you say your name, please?
I'm Margaret Roeder from Riverside, and I was wondering whether the Afghan people were aware of this young American State Department worker who was killed by a Taliban fighter.
Yeah, and she was going to deliver books to the Zabal province, yeah.
So that's something that people in Afghanistan would be aware of.
Thank you, Margaret. You know, Kabul is like a bubble. There's much more awareness of news going on with a lot of residents in Kabul because the electricity, there's more access to electricity. 3 to 5% of the country have access to the internet. So truthfully, beyond there, they may, unless the radio stations were broadcasting it, which they might have, it's not a given that they would know. But I'm almost sure, I'm so sorry to have not been on this phone call this morning that was going on when I left, but I'll check with the Afghan peace volunteers and ask them to give a statement, which it would be important to have. I think you probably know that this young woman was very local from 25 years old.
In River Forest, they have all the peoples in the neighborhoods have tied white ribbons around their trees in her memory.
Ah,
she's a Fenwick
grad. Yeah, I graduated from Fenwick. I hope that will ease the pain. Yeah.
The Presbyterian Church was handing out white ribbons, and then also had, if you want to donate a book in her memory, they're going to deliver
them
to the people in Afghanistan.
Wow. Thank you. Dale?
Could you comment on the effect that militarizing the State Department has had? I believe the woman worked for the State Department, was on a humanitarian mission, yet was surrounded by soldiers. And the conflation of the military and good deeds, the reality of that on the ground in a war zone, if you care.
Yeah, thank you. There is a kind of a coalition of 24 what they call non-governmental organizations in Afghanistan who have put out several reports. One is called Nowhere to Turn, Nowhere to Hide. And without rancor, but just sort of the common sense that people develop in a war zone, they've repeatedly, in these reports, asked the U.S. military not to blur the lines between military work and humanitarian work, because then they get identified as people that are there for military purposes and are just kind of putting a smokescreen over it by doing humanitarian work, and their lives are jeopardized. I mean, it's a war zone. I wouldn't say anybody's looking at safety with any sort of guarantee. But it's really curious. When I go over there, I never see another Westerner. Honestly, the plane is loaded with Westerners. But the Westerners are not allowed. Our niece is over there now, Kelly McKinnon, and I so admire her. She's with a project to try to clear land of landmines and then plant trees. And for her to get permission to come and see me, she had to have a driver and a secure vehicle and a little schedule worked out. And it probably wouldn't have been possible for me to go see her very easily, because I would have had to get some kind of security clearance, and I'm not so good at passing security clearances these days. No problem there. But it's true for the emergency hospital workers as well. I mean, they, it seems to me, have more safety than anybody with that big logo of a red E on the side of their vehicle, because everybody knows these are the people that stitch up anybody, so don't kill them. But they cannot, when I stayed with them for 1 week, I could not leave the hospital compound except to go back to where they were housing me, which was a one-block walk with a security person on either side of me. He wasn't armed. That's the way it is. Now, I walk all over the place and don't think twice about it. I don't go out late at night anymore, but I used to. So it has really shifted, because there's such antagonism against Westerners just as a big set. And I think that I have heard cab drivers say to the young people in the back of the cab with me, we were coming back from a museum that has landmines being displayed and cluster bombs and all the different weapons that are littered across the country. And the cab driver said to the young people, you shouldn't be associating with these foreigners. All of them want to exploit us and starve us. And even the curator for the museum had said something to that effect when we were walking through the museum to my friend who speaks Dari. So it certainly is the case that, you know, she was probably told to go certainly with protection, and unfortunately, tragically, her protection turned out to be what drew the attack. Yeah. I know, I think in fairness, we should also realize that it's beginning to be better known all across Afghanistan that President Obama on a Tuesday morning has a phone conference call with as many as 100 advisors trying to decide who they will target for assassination with the drones over the remaining days of the week. You know, so people feel like, well, wait a minute, you know, our lives aren't considered to be worth a plug nickel. And this has to be dealt with, the idea of, you know, the inequality in human lives. Thank you.
Well, two questions, really. When you're saying about your security clearance, I'm curious, do you have difficulty going back and forth? I mean, what airline are you flying? Are you on a no-fly list?
You know, I can't figure it out. I've known people who've got, you know, a teeny fraction of my rap sheet, and they're excluded. And I am now. This is funny to me. Yesterday, or 2 days ago, I went to Cleveland, and you know, as you can see, I'm not punctual. I used to be punctual, remember? And so I'm usually out charging along. But that United outfit gives me a card that actually lets me skip the whole security check deal. There's a special line, so. Yeah, I'm a frequent flyer. Yeah, so yeah, I try to do most of my flying on United, and they don't even check my bags anymore. I think that's just plain dumb. I have somebody stole my identity.
Oh, great!
Said, I thought, good luck. So a little moment of mercy and prayer for that person if the whole thing. So I don't know why these airlines are so easy.
Second part of my question is when you're over there, you don't have any security. When you go there and you're like staying with what, the Afghan peace volunteers, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this lady, you said that you don't see any other Westerners because they're required to have this security. Do you have that? I mean, are you able to move around freely, or do you have any security, or you're in a taxi with some people?
Yeah. Well, I've taken a taxi by myself to go to the airport. There was a big snowfall, and, usually it's, let's take Kathy to the airport and say goodbye, but then the planes were shut down, nothing's flying. So by the third day of let's take Kathy to the airport, I said, I'll just take a cab. And they said, oh, that's fine. I have, I wouldn't just get in a cab. I'd have somebody else negotiate the price and make sure that the driver knows where I want to go. Walking is, my Dari is not that great, but I can walk to the grocery store and buy little things.
You're in Western garb.
Well, I sure wouldn't wear this. You have to be covered down to your ankles, and or else have boots or pants on underneath, and make sure your hair is completely covered. And you stand out anyway. There's no way. In Iraq, I used to think, oh, I just want to take the garbage out. I'll stick the abaya on, and I'd walk out, and Kathy. You just are. That's the way we walk, I guess. But I don't want to make light of the danger for people. We have a delegation of four. Two DePaul teachers and two other people, one from the Eighth Day Center of Justice and our friend John Bokening, who's been over there before with Voices. And they're leaving on the 17th, and I'm really worried. 10 days, and they're big Americans, and, but I usually go by myself. I've been tag-teaming it with the Singaporean medical doctor, so that when he has to be out of the country, then I could be there. And he had a very hard time getting his visa renewed. So we've sent, in December, we had an actual delegation with Mairead McGuire and Anne Wright and others. But we did ask them, never go out with more than four at any given time. The situation in 2014 is of great huge concern to people in Afghanistan. And this maddeningly horrible development is that arms are pouring into Kabul and other parts of the country. And there are so many different drug lords and warlords and competitions, and they're all arming themselves to the teeth. And so that is almost a prescription for internecine warfare. And these young ones that I know are saying, no, we're not going to touch the guns. We don't want to carry them. We don't want to learn how to use them. We don't want anything to do with the weapons. We've seen enough of war, but it's a deep concern to people. Thank you.
Have you ever had any contact at all with the Taliban personally?
Maybe I won't answer that question. Okay. Thank you. There's been a law passed in the United States. A law has been passed, and I could tell you that in Pakistan, one man, I don't know if he was Taliban or not, but he took two long bus rides and had started his journey off by foot to come to a Christian interfaith center, but it was started by Christians, with Mahbubzada, who has since died. And he talked with us for a long time about his experiences with drone attacks in his village called Khaisor. And I honestly don't even remember his name, I'm sorry to say. But, I actually never thought to ask, well, are you or aren't you? there's a lawyer who formerly was a Taliban fighter and has become a lawyer, and Malvi Rahim, and he's fairly well known in Kabul, and he has come and talked with us. Beyond that, I honestly, the truth is, I just can't say yes or no because I'm not even sure. I do want to say to all of us that these days, with the kinds of draconian laws that are being passed, if someone were to be accused of having in any way given any support, including engaging in conversation about, say, human rights to the Taliban, you would be eligible to be pulled before a grand jury and possibly indicted. This is the world we're living in now. It's very unusual to me. You know, I don't censor myself too easily. Thank you.
What organizations help you the most over there?
Well, we prize the Afghan peace volunteers. They've been so good in helping us understand anything, and we get constant translation through Hakim. We do. Well, we buy voices, make sure that they get food and fuel and a place to live, and and we get that through stipends and passing the hat, and sometimes somebody will give us a good chunk of change, and we're very grateful. So it's all living on the edge. But this is a good thing. They really believe in living simply. They think that's a good thing, mm-hmm. to share resources and to live simply. And boy, they do. In the wintertime, you freeze to death. It's so cold. And, they just have one wood-burning stove, and when the wood burns out, you put on another layer of clothing. And they're now going to school as well, so there's an extra need on their part to take time to study and become students.
And how many volunteers are in that?
Well, there are 12 live-in. We opened up a second one-room joint because we didn't want it to look like Hazara yet, and there were more Hazaras than Pashto and Tajik, so four of the Hazaras are in a second place. But that's good, because then when the water gets cut off, we trot over to their place and try to get water from their well. So it's a good thing. And we have in the past 3 years moved every 6 months for security reasons. But I think with all the women coming in for the sewing co-op, we've already moved them once. Maybe we can get away without moving anytime soon.
Yeah, how do you do with the language? Uh-huh. Today, so English, I take it.
Two of the young people, Abdulhai and Faiz, are now, I would say, 80% to 90% fluent in English, which helps me a lot. And Hakim speaks 7 languages and is just brilliant. He's this medical doctor from Singapore who's been there since 2001.
So when they go to school, they speak Farsi? Oh,
yeah, they're speaking Dari. No, Farsi is like a, that means Iran, and there's a lot of tension between Iran and Afghanistan, and so the schools are not conducted in the Farsi language. There's still a tension because the two major languages are Pashto and Dari, and the Taliban people would be speaking Pashto. So even just what do you call the university? Do you call it by the Dari name for university or the Pashto name? That was a big fight. So it's not resolved entirely how courses will be taught. But the secondary level courses in Kabul are all taught in Dari, and that's the language of these kids. Pat.
Kathy, you've been there. When the Americans leave, what do you see happening?
Mm. Well, because of the buildup of all the weaponry, I can understand why people are mighty nervous. The economy is already experiencing setbacks because of the departure of Americans, because there was a lot of service that couldn't be trucked in that was, delivered by people who had jobs working with the Americans, and those jobs are going. Construction has just about come to a halt. Probably the drug trade will become, relied upon very, very much in many places. The Taliban have said they're not going to stop fighting until the Americans leave. Now, the only problem with what Pat said is that the Americans aren't leaving. General John Allen said 2 weeks ago, we'll be there. There will still be fighting. We'll be there fighting through 2015. The agreement that's being signed between President Karzai and President Obama says the troops will be there till 2024 or beyond. I think what's happening is that there's this discovery of natural gas and fossil fuels in the Caspian Sea basin. The Caspian Sea is way up on the edge of the stans, basically, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. And so China would understandably want to have access to those energy resources. They've got this huge population and burgeoning industry. So if the United States can build a pipeline across Afghanistan, and that's the route, the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, then the United States can determine the pricing and the flow of that oil. And so they've also now, I know we've all got cell phones and at least one computer here, inside of those cell phones and computers, there are substances like lithium and dibithium and some other substances like rare earth minerals that are found in the Hindu Kush mountain range. Mm-hmm. And so whoever builds the roadways for extracting and transporting those substances can again control the pricing and the flow and say to China, well, we're the ones who built that roadway. We built that pipeline. We'll tell you how much you're going to have to pay to use these resources. Now, China doesn't have 1,000 military bases spread all around the world to try and take care of. So the Chinese can be, I think, a lot more streamlined. They've already built a railroad from the port of Gwadar in Pakistan all the way up to northern border with China, between Afghanistan and China. And this warlord that's up there, an Afghan warlord, is, you know, trying to get as much as he can out of the Chinese financially to let China cross into the area. So would the Taliban actually lay down their weapons? Are they ready to quit? Could be. You know, this has been a long haul, and many, many people killed, and families without breadwinners, and just people that are without limbs and eyesight, and they've suffered. The U.S. troops have suffered. The family here of the young woman who has just died will be suffering. I mean, maybe there will be more of a readiness to say, let's move forward without continued fighting. But what worries me is that all of the smaller groups have now armed themselves out of fear that absent the U.S. troops, they're not going to have any way to defend themselves. There's very low confidence in the president, Hamid Karzai. You know, it's typical in a village for a woman to be allowed to go to the marketplace once a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unimaginable to me to be able to leave my house or my neighborhood once a year. So I wouldn't last very long, I don't think, under Taliban strictures, under that kind of codifying. But it was never law, it was never the constitutional law that women would be treated so badly. Under President Hamid Karzai, because he's beholden to these warlords and Taliban figures, otherwise he'd be killed, or he wouldn't be able to stay in office, he wouldn't be able to get anything done, they pretty well twisted his arm so that he introduced into law, and it now is a law, that a woman is not equal to the man at the university, in the workplace, or in her own home. So if a woman disobeys her husband, no matter what he asks, she's also disobeying Afghan law. And that's under the president that the United States has pretty well propped up and supported all these years. So when, as sometimes happens, I think the United States has tried to say that our wars are humanitarian, that we're fighting to preserve people's security and rights, I just don't think any war is ever a humanitarian war. It's not possible. There's no such thing as a humanitarian war. And at any rate, women have not fared better under the United States presence, not with those stats like the ones I offered to you earlier, not with women coming and crying, saying they're losing their mind because they can't feed their children. Thank you.
I mean, do we Americans, does the president have the ability to work with anybody but Karzai? We can't go in and handpick the guy we want.
Well, but this is why there's so much anger on the part of many people in Afghanistan who don't like Karzai. They say that that he stole the election, that it was a fraudulent election, that the fraud was writ large, very clear. The UN agreed that it was a fraudulent election. And President Obama called him up and said, congratulations, and kind of sealed the deal. So, politically, it's such a fraught situation. There is one person who came in third in the presidential elections, Ramazan Bashar Dost. He drives around in an old Mr. Bean car, wears this white ice cream suit with a kind of Afghan flag as a sort of a tie part. And when you go to meet him, you sit on plastic chairs outside of a pup tent in a vacant lot. I love this guy. he makes the Catholic worker houses look sort of posh, you know. And when he gets his paycheck, he goes right to the vacant lot and gives it out to people, distributes it. They've got a very, you know, well worked out distribution system. So he doesn't own anything. And he came in third in the run for the presidency. He's a graduate of the Sorbonne. He's very smart, a little quirky, but anyway, he feels there should be a time when there's the governance of Afghanistan is entrusted to an entity like the United Nations until such time as they can begin to bring all of the warlords to accountability. He's not trying to lock them up. He just wants them to acknowledge what they've stolen, what they've done, and give back, and then start all over again. That seems like a tall order, huh? He's so beloved, but nobody thinks that, you know, that there's reality to what he says. But people do love him in the country, really, really love him. Also, 65%, according to the head of Australian Aid, 65% of the population are under 18. Normally, you see under 25, but that's a young country. So maybe the young ones can get an act together, more or less, and say, hey, you know, if we keep fighting each other, we're just all the it's easier for outside entities to exploit us, and every one of our neighbors is an outside entity that wants to exploit us, and you can toss in the United States as well. Thank you. He was on the board of directors for Unocal, the company that started building the pipeline, yeah.
And he lived in Northern Virginia for 25 years.
His brothers still run restaurants. In fact, one of his brothers had a restaurant in Chicago. Yeah. He was an import, yeah.
I wanted to ask about the trial of this Sergeant Bales.
Oh, yeah.
He killed all those people.
17 people, yeah.
And how many years is this, you know, this is this bizarre little thing, and how exactly did he go insane, because he must have been insane, and but there was a lot of talk in Afghanistan, I guess, in Pakistan, that this might have just been a fairly typical night raid that spun a little out of control, but that one reason that there was not, like, this uproar across Afghanistan is that this was not the first time this had happened.
Well, I can't imagine that he would not have been deranged when he committed that crime, if in fact he did commit the crime. I think there will be much more attention paid to that instance than to the many, many, many instances. It's about once a week that we post something on that Afghan atrocities update, about once a week. Women, children, grandparents, civilians on mountainsides, civilians in their homes. It's just, oh, there might be one more chair. Here we go. Okay. Thank you.
Not a question, just more of a comment. I'm envious of you still feeling heartened and hopeful. I can't find that in me. I just listen to you and think, how can you know so much more even, you know, than we know, and still.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to minimize the suffering of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, in these places where war has been their constant fare. But, you know, how close did the abolitionists think they were when slavery came to an end in the lifetime of some of them? You know, we can't predict what's coming around the corner, and that's what gives me hope. Now, it could be something really awful, you know. But it, those of you who are in the Catholic Church, we couldn't predict an Archbishop Oscar Romero. And what a fountain of hope that man's life and witness became. There are different views, but by and large, I think Mikhail Gorbachev was a big surprise, and who could predict that the Berlin Wall was going to come down? I think with the environmental acceleration of, you know, damage to the planet, and with things like Fukushima, you know, people's children in California are having thyroid problems. You know, we share this one planet, and I think people might, even within some of the very big groupings, start to think, hey, we've got to get a grip. There's too much recklessness going on, and we've entrusted all of our resources to the military. It's not productive of new jobs at any rate that we would create new jobs if, for instance, we were investing in mass transit, bullet speed trains, retrofitting the housing stock, creating jobs for elder care, jobs for child care. I mean, I think that some of the practicalities could start to dawn even on people who are making a profit. Now, the gamble would they be willing to say, okay, maybe we won't make as much of a profit or not as short-term a profit, but we'll start to examine new things. In Maine, there's a place called the Bath Iron Works in Bath, Maine, and they make Aegis destroyers. And the factory floor circulated a petition. It took a couple years, but they, you know, did their homework. They educated one another, and they went to the owners and they said, we want to make wind turbines. And they did their homework so well that the owners of the factory, maybe also starting to realize that the 21st century military might not really want these big old Aegis destroyers all that badly, they've now imported engineers from Scandinavia to teach them how you make a profit from making wind turbines. So we might see some accelerated changes. It's not terribly hopeful, but I mean, the Occupy movement may seem short-lived, but in 12 weeks, that movement had globalized the logo 99-in-1 and made people wonder, well, which one am I part of, the 1% or the 99%? You know, and has raised that question of global inequalities. I'm just over the weekend seeing a quick, rapid movement for globalizing the protests against drone warfare. People in different countries are writing and saying, hey, yeah, I want to be in on that too. So there's no end to the work we could do. But maybe the ONU and then you, sir?
How do you feel about the drone here in this country, which seems to be escalating? Parts of the country having drones here. I mean,
it's really the Lady Gaga of the industry in terms of policing and.
Where I live in Prescott, they're doing it's happening, and it's a big area. In Arizona.
Well, at least there's more discussion. I mean, we were arrested and went to trial back in 2010 for vigiling for 12 days, and then just crossing the line with the international indictment that said the special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings back then had said that he believed that these drones were in violation of international law. So we just stepped over the line with that. The judge in our case said, after he listened to all the testimony, I'm going to need 4 months to think about this. Wow. I mean, usually it's just case closed, bang. I mean, he did found us guilty after 4 months, but still he took 4 months to think about it. I'd rather be found guilty by somebody who takes 4 months to think about it than somebody who said, no, it's lunchtime. But that to me was exciting to see, because there's a whole lot. The New York Times recently did a whole big thing on drones, and you just never see this. It's some cause that the peace movement is really interested in is getting attention from the Washington Post and the New York Times all in 1 week. So some of these issues might be poking out there, and globally there are lots of questions being raised about the drone proliferation. Leona?
Well, I was just going to ask you to comment about the military budget, because it's going to be slashed, and Laurel was saying only 45% of its 47% of the current budget So that's got to be a good thing.
Well, they are closing many of the bases in other countries, and we have 1,000 of them. I don't think that they'll cut back on the special operations forces, the drone warfare, and the training of special operations. Special operations refers to the Rangers, the Navy SEALs, and the Green Berets. And in Afghanistan, for instance, they'll close big bases. But right now, the company called Blackwater, for instance, they've changed their name to Academy, A-C-A-D-E-M-I. And they're building a 10-acre new facility outside of Kabul that's called Camp Integrity. And they'll be training special operations forces. That's the whole point of it. So how are they going to wage the war in the future? The drones will identify who the high-value target is, and then the special operations forces will be working with the drones, either to do night raids or call in combat brigade unit helicopters. And so they won't need the big, huge... I think what they want to do is keep an eye on the route for the new trucking roads they want to build and for the pipeline they want to build and make sure that that'll be secured. And I think that's part of why this military presence would continue. But things like that are happening all over the world, all across Africa, in this new Asian necklace that they're trying to build with the Asia pivot. So I think we should welcome the cuts in military spending and certainly welcome military researchers who are starting to say our defense really rests in living in more accord with the environment and in finding out ways to solve our problems related to poverty. So that's good. Two very top Marine officers created a report about a year ago, and I hope that'll get some traction. But yeah, that's a hopeful sign. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nancy.
I have a question that seems very dumb to me. So you'll forgive me.
She told me there are no dumb questions when I was 15.
Table's turned.
I mean, I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, the drones and the special forces and the... What the hell are we doing there? Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but what's our objective?
Mm.
How are we threatened by what is happening?
See, I think we're in a Cold War with China. China shares a very small border with Afghanistan. China shares a much larger border with Pakistan, right? And if China can, like Forbes said, it would take 40 years for China to catch up to the United States as the world's largest economy. Now they've said, well, actually, that might happen in 10 to 12 years. So with China catching up to the United States, we want, I think, the State Department and the Pentagon want to be able to say to the Chinese authorities, yes, you want these resources in your neighboring countries, but we have already beaten you to the punch in terms of building pipelines and roadways. We control those, and so we'll determine how much you pay for your resources. Because if China can get access to precious and irreplaceable resources at cheaper amounts than what we have, they'll catch up to us economically faster. And the sun could well be setting on the U.S. empire. Empires don't go down quietly. I seem to remember someone having told me once. That's him. Jerry Ryan. Empires don't go down quietly, as he read Time magazine. We were sure you knew everything. The world was safe because you knew everything. It's still safe in that regard of people sharing knowledge. And I think, you know, it could be that that the United States planners will eventually say, you know, there's nothing that's worth what we're doing in Afghanistan. But, you know, I doubt that anybody in anybody's congressional district is calling their elected representative on a Monday morning and saying, hey, I want you to be more aggressive in that war against Afghanistan. I want you... Yeah, people are tired of the war. The polls have shown repeatedly, get out, quit, no more. But the...
I'm going back. You know, we were all convinced that the communists, many centuries ago, were out to get us, right?
the world was, I can't figure out what the threat, why do the U.S. people say, oh yes, we're at war against Afghanistan? And you're probably right. It's probably this complicated thing with China and the pipeline and who's going to control what. But do the people of the United States know that? I mean, why do we just go along with this?
Well, I do think people are basically good-hearted. I think there's a guy named Dr. John Tierman at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who wrote a book called The Deaths of Others, and he was gobsmacked when he figured out that he had done the research, he'd issued the report that 600,000 Iraqi people died after the U.S. 2003 invasion, and it was kind of a big shrug. He thought for sure this was really going to rattle people across country in academia, in the news, in the faith-based communities, and there wasn't much of a ripple. So then he set himself a new research task. And in his book, The Deaths of Others, he wants to know why U.S. people can be so seemingly indifferent in the face of statistics that show that our wars of choice have caused so much death and suffering. And what he came up with is that the Vietnam syndrome has been put to rest, more or less. You know, after the Vietnam War, many people said, that's it. We do not want to go into another war like the Vietnam War. So the Vietnam syndrome had to be eradicated. Well, we saw that happen. You make sure there's no civilian draft, make sure that there aren't pictures coming back of people coming back amputated with amputations and terrible wounds, make sure that it's not widely known that the greatest harm for soldiers in combat is self-inflicted harm. Make sure you don't get the photos of the suffering. And then if you can convince the U.S. people that by and large it's a humanitarian war, you're home free, because you'll get not malicious indifference, but a sense of, well, you know, I don't want to be out there ahead of the pack resisting something. Maybe there is a need for it. And so that's what happened with Saddam Hussein. You know, pretty soon people were saying, well, you know, we did get rid of Saddam Hussein. They should be kind of grateful, shouldn't they? And even though it was 52% disapproval of the war in Iraq last week, I thought, oh, no, it was 65% disapproval 2 years ago. So they're softening that one up. And these are some of the highest paid think tanks in the world whose job is to convince the U.S. public that the wars are humanitarian. And I see it. I get a chance to go around to a lot of people's living rooms and church basements and high schools, and I'm constantly being told, well, you know, we have to protect the women and children of Afghanistan, don't we? And, you know, Greg Mortensen's book would be stacked up on the coffee tables of people. And, you know, he certainly started more schools than I ever did. But Greg Mortensen was used by the U.S. military. They would say, oh, we give all our guys Greg Mortensen's book before they go out on these night raids. Like they're, you know, knocking on the door at 2 in the morning to say, could we join you for tea? We forgot that third cup. So they know how to do it. They know how to spin it. There was a PBS special that some people have shown, and I come and they say, oh, to get ready for you, we showed you this PBS special about women and war. And yeah, it shows the women cuddling the babies in the Chahari Kambar refugee camp. It never tells it. It's $2 billion a week to keep these women and men in the bases right next to these refugee camps. It never tells that the women are being sent into the refugee camp to try and soften them up and make them, you know, give information and things like that. It doesn't go on about, it just makes it, and then they quote Madeleine Albright and Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton all talking about, you know, how war is so hard on women, but they're, you know, with the other hand, they're feeding the war effort. Amnesty International, when the NATO forces were here for their summit, Amnesty International launched a campaign not to bring the troops home in order to save the women and children of Afghanistan. You can't believe the gall of it sometimes. But the person who had been sent over to head Amnesty International formerly worked for the State Department. With Hillary Clinton.
Is there any examples, and I doubt it, of any government program in Afghanistan that really helps the people, not the NGOs like you do, but you know, they put that out there as what they're doing. You know, this is what we're supposed to be doing.
Well, I think that in the short term, you would, I mean, I'm sympathetic to this, actually, because, okay, good, we got this duvet project up and running. Do I think that I'm going to be raising $40,000 for the next 10 years to make sure the duvet project stays up and running? You know, I think, oh, no, what have I done? So sustainability is not easy. And so what's happened is that they might get a project up and running that has some success, and then they're gone.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I look at my niece and think, oh, that is wonderful. You know, she's getting in there at a young age. I'm sure she'll have the language down pat pretty soon. But a lot of times people go over for a few years and then, you know, they're switched. If they're really good, they're sent someplace else to be really good. And so that's one problem. Another is that the special inspector general for Afghanistan research issued his report, and he said that the amount of money the U.S. has spent just on development is now approaching $100 billion. So in the aggregate, with $100 billion, my gosh, you could give a Mercedes-Benz and a house to probably a good number of them. But how come there's no electricity working in the provinces? How come even in Kabul there's sometimes not electricity? How come all the refugees are in such wretched conditions and there are 400 new refugees every day? How come there's such a high incidence of people dying in childbirth? The hospitals are horrible. Any of you involved in healthcare delivery, you'd feel your heart skip a number of beats if you saw these hospitals, not the emergency ones, but because they don't have nurses, if you get sick, you bring your family with you. And the families are, you know, feeding themselves, and there isn't anybody to do the cleanup. If they don't have nurses, they sure don't have, you know, a big number of cleaning people, and sometimes people start to fight amongst each other, and you have to bring your own blankets and bring your own sheets and bring your own food, and they're just, and the doctors aren't very well trained anymore. So sustainable development, there's a guy named Ahmed Rashid who's beloved by the State Department. He's a very good writer, and he has said that the United States just isn't very good at creating sustainable entrepreneurial economies, and that's what's needed for the long haul. And so sure, there are going to be, you know, some farming cooperatives that got new tools and were able to do, you know, a better planting season. And there are projects that have been good. But the NGOs collectively, the strongest, Oxfam, Bread for the World, Save the Children, International Commission for the Red Cross, have as a unit said, please get out of humanitarian work. You're making our lives more at risk. I would say the United Nations has earned a trustworthy track record in its 38 agencies that are there for mine clearance, for food distribution, for World Health Organization efforts. And then certainly in a larger scale, Save the Children, Oxfam, and CARE, and International Commission of the Red Cross. Thanks, Siobhan.
What's going on with the Gitmo hunger strike?
Oh, I'm
That's
so glad
my
you
one
mentioned
question.
That.
The second question is, when people talk about Zero Dark 30, what is your stock answer to that?
Well, it's day 68 of the hunger strike on the part of men in Guantanamo. 166 men are there. At least 30 have been cleared of all charges and should just be released, but it's a diplomatic issue with the government of China because some are Muslim Chinese. They're called Uyghurs, and so they're being held even though they've been cleared. Shakir Amer is to be released to Britain. The British government, they're our ally, are begging, let him come back. We'll take him. He's still there. Now they have forced some of the hunger strikers into their rooms. They can't leave their rooms. Three are in the hospital. 11 are being force-fed. These are statistics we're trying to get. It's not so easy to get the statistics. The lawyers have been very, very good in being of support to the hunger strikers and also trying to let people beyond know. But they're just desperate. They're so very, very desperate. Some of those men have been locked up now for 11 years. So we've done a We did a week-long hunger strike in solidarity with them, and that was happening in cities all across the country, New York, Chicago, Milwaukee, Los Angeles. And now it's kind of a rotating fast. People can take a day of the fast. And I think there will be ongoing actions. If you ever see people wearing orange jumpsuits and black hoods, that's the Witness Against Torture group. And we've been down at the federal building quite a lot. Oh, great, great. I was out of town, but I'm glad to hear that. Is there another action plan?
Not that I have been reading about yet.
Uh-huh.
But it's always, you know, in emails and on Facebook and something, but not an action plan, as I know.
Uh-huh. It's so maddening because instead of closing down Guantanamo, the current administration has closed down the one office that was assigned to work to try to get people out of Guantanamo and housed somewhere else. They've had three go to the Bahamas and two to El Salvador, and that's it. Even though there are communities all across the United States who say, we'll take them.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking about that. You know, for Zero Dark 30, I haven't come much further than when I was in college and I thought Farrah Fawcett was a plumbing company. I just don't know anything. That Hunger Games, I was so excited. I thought, oh, this is great. Athletes are trying to raise money for world hunger. And I tell myself something that's completely not true. And then one of my sisters will say, you idiot. So I just, I know it's a movie.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. It's not a radio show. It's not a... I think the Witness Against Torture people, while I was in Afghanistan, actually did an action in relation to it. Yeah, but popularizing the idea of torture is
And that it works. that's what they said.
Yeah, no, I think that's been. I mean, people say anything when they're under torture. Yeah, I'll try to find out more about that. Thank you.
I think you'd be going down Tuesday to Durban's.
Oh, very. I heard they've been delayed till the 23rd, but that may not be true. I hope if people are going to Washington, they'll go ahead and keep going. I'm headed to Hartford, Connecticut that day.
I thought it was supposed to be this Tuesday.
You're right, and I hope that goes on, but it may be that the hearings are being delayed, but that's okay. People should still gather. Can you give the time at the federal building?
Is it 10? 10? Down at the federal building. I think you have to RSVP to be there, and there's supposed to be an overflow room.
Uh-huh.
But they're trying to encourage as many people to come down and witness, and a lot of peace groups have actually submitted testimony, which will then go into the official hearing records.
Because Senator Durbin is in charge of the Judiciary Committee that's going to be looking at issues about the legality of drones. Thank you. That's really important. I don't want to keep all of you here beyond a reasonable time. I want to say thank you very, very much to each of you for coming out today. If you ever come into Chicago, we're right off the Argyle L stop on the Red Line. You're welcome to come on over and visit or stay as long as you like. there's some literature back there. My friend David Smith Ferry is a really wonderful poet. I had a long bus ride through Virginia, and I reread his poems on Afghanistan. I thought, oh, these are really good poems. So if you have a bent toward poetry, that book is there. Some of you would remember Studs Terkel. When I got out of prison, he was waiting for me with a red rose. He was very dear. He liked us a lot. Our young ones would go shovel his snow and stuff. And so he co-narrates a dated film that Jackie Rivet Rivers made, but I've been pulling it out again because the end of it is about Afghanistan. But it's mostly with regard to Voices' efforts in Iraq. And then I have some of these scarves that the women make. When they're not making duvets, they're making scarves. My new role is to be hawking stuff. But anyway, these are very nice blue scarves. Oh, I'm not wearing one. Anyway, they're very nice blue scarves. And those are back there, and more to come. I'll spend all of May in Afghanistan and be back in Chicago in mid-July. We're going to do a walk. Pat, this will be wonderful for you. You could organize the hell out of something like this. Pat's very good at being organized. She gets us all organized. But we're going to walk from Rock Island to one of those D cities in Iowa.
Des Moines.
Des Moines, Rock Island to Des Moines, yeah. Davenport's right near Rock Island. That would have been a nice walk. Yeah, Rock Island to Des Moines. The last time we did one from Chicago to Minneapolis, I think my feet stopped hurting about 7 months later. Oh, my goodness. But these are healthy things to do. And so if you want to come and walk with us for a while, it's to protest the drone warfare. The Rock Island Arsenal is making some of the iron that's used for our weaponry, and Des Moines now has a full drone warfare section in the Air National Guard airport there. They're really starting up everywhere. Volk Field in Wisconsin has one going, Camp Ripley in Minnesota, so that many more pilots are graduating to work as drone operators than are going into the cockpits and flying airplanes. So it's a new form of 21st century warfare. So there's also our newsletter back there, and a brochure. That
did you want to show any of your PowerPoint?
Oh, but it's 10 to 4.
Okay.
Yeah. If you we have loads of pictures. Oh, yes, very important. Our Journey to Smile. Sounds a bit saccharine, but that's the website for the Afghan Peace Volunteers. It was so named because our friend Hakim was in the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he got to know this little kid, Najib, who became close to the healthcare workers and then said, I'm going to stop being a rag picker and a garbage picker and try to make my way to Iran. And so Hakim just wanted to take his picture before he left, and he, you know, as you just say, he said, smile, and the grandmother went ballistic. This child was an orphan in her care. And she said, how dare you tell that child to smile? He's never had anything to smile about, and he never will. And so that's when he started this website, Our Journey to Smile, a journey toward giving every child something to smile about. And then the Global Days of Listening website, the 21st of every month is one of these Skype phone calls. So if you're up and able to get to a computer and get on Skype at 9 o'clock in the morning, you can just be part of the call. If you wanted to get on a conference call, there's a number that you could call into and participate in that way. And then we'll be sending one person over to help with relief work for refugees from Syria over the summer, Josh Berlier. He's speaking Arabic well enough to be of some good use there. And I'll be, and Buddy will be taking turns going over to Afghanistan. So we'll hope to have some worthwhile report back. Three of us were just in Gaza after the 8-day bombing. And so if anybody has a community that would be particularly interested in Gaza and the West Bank and Israel, we'd be happy to come and talk about that. We'll come anywhere at any time. It's our privilege to be with groups like yourselves. Thank you. Stephanie. Oh, the Dalou family.
Yeah,
we were at that house and spoke with the surviving brother. That'll be hard news.
Mm-hmm. I've got pin sheets back here on upcoming gatherings, rallies, if any of you are so inclined to join people. Tomorrow there is a war resistors rally at Federal Plaza from 10 to 2. Bring your signs.
Oh.
They have a literature. Bring your signs.
Yeah, I'll be there. We have some of the literature back there, too.
Global Day of Resistance Against War Spending or something like that.
Yeah. And thank you to Laurel and her group for inviting us all to come together.